Hello everybody, this is Salil Tripathi in Geneva at the UN Business and Human Rights Forum. I am with Professor Surya Deva, who is a recent addition to the Working Group for Business and Human Rights. He teaches at the City University of Hong Kong. He's a professor of law from India and he is representing Asia, but of course his interests are global in this issue. So first of all, congratulations on your appointment, Surya.
Thank you very much, Salil. Pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, my first question is this, that what do you think the working group should be doing? What are your plans as you're part of the working group now?
As you may know, the working group is almost as old as the UN guiding principles, and we have a broad mandate in terms of disseminating and implementing the guiding principles. We also wish to improve access to remedy, provide some concrete recommendations. We also would like to share good practices, and of course the forum that where we are talking is also a platform to share good practices about these particular ideas. Now in terms of the future agenda, I think we felt, we had this discussion within the working group, and we felt that the working group has not done enough so far in terms of pillar 3 on access to remedy. So in coming years, the working group would like to focus more on the access to remedy elements of the guiding principles. This does not mean that we will ignore the work that we have done so far. So we'll continue to push for the NAP process, we'll continue to push for human rights due diligence guidelines and all that. But at the end of the day, the crucial point is that unless there is an effective remedy, rights are useless.
Right.
I mean, they mean little to the people working in mines, in factories, and in tribal areas, you know. And that's why we think it is of paramount importance for the working group to build more on access to pillar, access to remedy pillar. And as you may know, we have joined another group, another colleague of mine, Anita Ramasastri. So
yes.
Anita and I will be...
She has been our fellow. In fact, she's a senior fellow at the Institute.
So Anita and I then will be focusing on access to remedy together in coming years. And we hope to present 2 to 3 reports to the Council as well as General Assembly. So for instance, next year in June 2017, there will be a report on cross-border cases in the context of access to remedy. Then in October next year, there will be another report to the UN General Assembly, which again is going to be on access to remedy. And potentially, there could be report third one on access to remedy in 2018 to the Council. So there are a number of things. One issue which is very critical is that the guiding principles identify a number of barriers to access to justice. Now the question is, how could we remove these barriers in access to justice? And in that particular context, I think a concrete guidance to states how these barriers could be removed will be very useful. That's what we feel. So we'll start a process of consultation with all the relevant stakeholders, and then we will make some concrete recommendations to states. We will build on the Office of the High Commissioner's work on the accountability and remedy project, but we would like to fill in the gaps in that work and also go beyond in terms of making concrete recommendations. There are other things which, because what happens in the working group, all five of us have internal discussion and then we come up with certain themes in terms of the priority areas. And then each member of the working group will pick up certain themes in coming years. So for instance, I will be focusing on at least 3 components in coming years. One is, I already mentioned to you, access to remedy, and I'll be focusing on civil remedies as part of state-based judicial remedies. And then I will focus on non-state-based grievance mechanism.
Do you mean the arbitration panel, for example? That's an idea being talked about.
That may be a possibility. We can also talk about operational level grievance mechanism, like the company is establishing some grievance mechanism at their sites to deal with those particular situations. It could also mean multi-stakeholder initiatives that could be put together. It could also involve community-led initiatives, something which has been experimented by, for instance, by Arthritis International and all
that.
So these are a range of possibilities. Guiding principles hint about these possibilities.
Yes.
But now our role as a working group is to expand,
dig deeper and drill down.
And make it concrete. The second is going to be on bilateral investment treaties and human rights. So I'm going to lead the working group work in this particular theme. And the key idea again is going to be that we come up with some concrete models, mm-hmm. let us say 2 or 3 models for states, that how should they integrate human rights in their bilateral investment treaties, mm-hmm. and whatever work we do is going to be relevant in the context of international or regional investment agreements as well. And here the link with the guiding principles is going to be principle number 9, mm-hmm. which provides that the state should have this policy space, but how do they do it? Mm-hmm. So we want to provide guidance in terms of that. Mm-hmm. My third and last theme is going to be on gender issues.
Right, very good.
And because again, we are mandated to pay special attention to the gender lens and also other weaker sections of society who are more vulnerable in those particular situations. And again, there is a feeling that the working group has not given enough attention to these elements. Mm-hmm. We have, of course, touched about it in mm-hmm. their other reports, but mm-hmm. it's not the mainstreaming of the issues. Mm-hmm. So we would like to perhaps do specific work in the context of CEDAW, for instance. Mm-hmm. What is the direct relevance of CEDAW in the context of business?
This is, of course, a convention for the elimination of discrimination against women.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned gender, because as you probably know, we at the Institute have been working for much of this year with the Office of the High Commission of Human Rights on Free and Equal campaign,
yes.
on mainstreaming the guiding principles such that there is no discrimination against LGBT people.
Absolutely.
And it's something that we would certainly want to contribute to when we come to that.
Yes.
I wanted to go back to the guiding principles, which we've had for more than 5 years now.
Yeah.
And the specific question I have is that you still hear frustration from the civil society that they don't go far enough. And they don't go far enough probably because they were never mandated to go that far by the Human Rights Council. Mm-hmm. Now, how can the mechanism of the grievance mechanism be operationalized and strengthened without undermining existing judicial mechanism? I'll tell you what I mean by that, mm-hmm. is that one concern civil society often has is that if you have operational level grievance mechanism, it will be at the expense of domestic remedies, such as a court.
Sure.
And therefore, you may have a company controlled environment, where there's not enough transparency, not enough accountability, not enough respect for the rule of law.
Sure.
So would you come up with some basic criteria, minimum criteria that are needed for an operational grievance mechanism to succeed? How do you see the guiding principles having, 2.0 version so that it takes the whole process forward?
Sure. Now, this is a very good question. And as you may know, Principle 31 identifies a number of criteria
which
must be satisfied.
Yeah.
So the key test for us is going to be how could we unpack further those criteria.
Uh-huh. Right.
What does it mean to say that these mechanisms should be rights compatible?
Right.
And one critical issue here is that can access to judicial reviews be excluded or not?
Mm-hmm.
And my personal view is that any such mechanism should not exclude access to judicial reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it tries to do that, it will be controversial.
Yes.
But this is an open question, but I'm just sharing my personal views.
And I share the view. I mean, absolutely. Because anything that undermines the rule of law is fundamentally problematic.
Yes. So I see a role for these mechanisms, not in lieu of judicial systems mm-hmm. and mechanisms, but in addition to that,
complementing.
So they could be effective because you're not relying on legal mm-hmm. tools. So let us say if you're not relying on legal arguments, then the companies will not plead doctrine of corporate, separate corporate personality.
Yep.
Forum non-convenience will not be an issue, right? So and the cost may be less. Delay may be less, perhaps,
yeah.
we don't know, but perhaps, So there will be certain advantages.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes these mechanisms could be closer to the victims.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes the victims are living at a far remote area.
Yes.
The judicial system is 500 kilometers away.
Mm.
They may not have the time, they may not have the means.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, 500 kilometers may look very short distance.
Mm-hmm.
If you have money and if you have the transportation like helicopters and flights.
Yes.
But sometimes, still we have many parts in the world where 500 kilometers could mean 24 hours
journey. Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's why it is very critical that we appreciate the value of a number of tools.
Mm.
I'm a great believer of not having an either-or mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the business and human rights community, not everyone, but many, still have this mindset.
Yeah.
Obsession with something which is one element or one tool or one initiative.
Yes.
I'm a great believer of using a number of tools together
mm-hmm.
in a cohesive way.
Mm-hmm.
and hopefully the working group can push the agenda in this particular way.
No, distance is a very good example, because in my time as a researcher at Amnesty, I remember we were in Niger Delta, I'm talking about 2004, and the oil company that was operating there, which was Shell, which was leaving its environmental impact assessment in the state capital, which they thought was enough, which was Yenagoa, but the villages in the delta, where the impact was there, needed about a 24-hour journey by boats and through the creeks, even to go to read the assessment. And so our suggestion, one of them was that when you do the assessment, make sure that every village gets it and not simply be kept at the state capital. Yes. So you're absolutely right about how the distance can be a barrier, and there are no internet connections in those places. So you can't say that we put it on the web. That's also not good enough. Absolutely right. Sure. My final question kind of deals with the whole discussion about the treaty. And I understand that the working group itself will not have a view on what the treaty should be like.
Yeah.
But what do you think would be the good features of such a treaty? I mean, do we want, everybody wants grievances to be settled.
Sure.
But you were mentioning how a village could be 500 kilometers from the place of the capital. Clearly, you know, for the same villager to get justice from Geneva or New York is going to be even harder.
Sure.
So what do you think the folks who are excited about treaties should be focusing on?
Sure. I mean, let me start with the working group situation.
Yeah.
So we had some internal discussion about the treaty, and the working group as such, we support the process, but we have not yet had a discussion about the substance and the content. Yeah. And so I think I will not speak on that particular element.
Fair enough.
But in my personal view, I think the treaty could complement the guiding principles.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, again, going back to my either-or mindset, I will not suggest any state or any actor to have this either-or mindset. And I take the position that if you support the guiding principles and you are sincere about it, you cannot oppose the treaty.
Right.
Because the treaty is likely to make certain elements of the guiding principles, or all of the guiding principles, kind of legally binding under international law.
Right.
So if you say, let us say part of Pillar 2, that the business has a responsibility to respect human rights, and then you say we follow Pillar 3 as well, which is access to remedy, then it is inescapable that you should not have any difficulty in making these responsibility legally binding.
Absolutely.
Why should you worry about it?
So
that is my point. At the same time, I am a strong believer that if you support the treaty, you must also implement the guiding principles carefully and sincerely.
Yeah.
So I'm making this request to both the camps.
Yeah.
The treaty camp or the guiding principles camp.
Yes.
If we have these two camps. But increasingly, and especially the last session of the Intergovernmental Working Group on Treaty last month, I felt that we have see a convergence. So we see emergence of a middle ground where they see that increasingly we should use the guiding principles as a springboard for the treaty.
Right.
So the treaty should build on the guiding principles. It should start there. It need not end at the guiding principles. So it could go beyond them.
Yeah.
Now the critical component in my view of any treaty, if it has to be making any difference, it has to be victim-centric.
Right.
Can we change anything for the victims, which the current initiatives are not able to do, including the guiding principles?
Yes.
And then I think the big elephant in the room is, how do you deal with those situations where there is no clear business case for human rights?
Right.
And states are unwilling
or unable,
to go after the business. So in my view, this treaty has to be innovative.
Mm-hmm.
It should not try to decentralize too much, that you have created a system far, far away, and you, because you're dealing with not even 200 states.
Right.
You're dealing with millions and billions of companies.
Yeah.
And that's why there may be an element of centralization in terms of creating a mechanism or forum for certain abuses. But otherwise, we have to go local and try to provide systems at the domestic level, in my view. The treaty could be useful in a number of ways. Just to provide a concrete example, in many cases that we see, what is happening is that state is not in the picture. A law firm or a civil society organization is negotiating a settlement agreement with a relevant company.
Yeah.
State is not there.
Yeah.
In my view, if you have this binding instrument, which especially if it imposes direct obligations on business, it could enhance the leverage of this negotiation, the leverage of the victims.
Mm-hmm.
Now, victims rely on the guiding principles.
Yes.
Which in my view are not entirely voluntary, but there's a perception that the guiding principles are voluntary.
Yes, yes.
So in my view, let us head on deal with this perception. And if you make it concrete that the business has a responsibility and which is legally binding, because the word responsibility could also mean legal duty. I mean,
yes,
the guiding principles has been differentiated, but under international law, like we talk about estate responsibility. And there the word responsibility means binding obligations.
Indeed.
So something that we should be aware of, right? So the guiding principles are very critical component. We should try to implement both the states as well as the business enterprises. But in my view, we need more tools in our armor to deal with the situation. Treaty is going to be one additional. It will not solve everything in my view. You might perhaps need a number of treaties.
Right.
Or you might need something more.
Right.
But I see this as an additional tool, the time of which has come.
Wonderful. It's a fascinating journey that lies ahead of you. All the best to you, and we would love to support you every which way we can.
Thank you, Salil.
Thank you so much indeed.
Thank you for having me.